You've likely heard of Greek gods such as Zeus and Apollo, but in Boston, they celebrate a Greek god you may not be familiar with. His name is Aganis, the Greek god of baseball, and he is one of the most talented athletes ever to come out of New England. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. Aristotle George Aganis was born April 20th, 1929, in Lynn, Massachusetts, to parents George and Georgia Aganis. His parents met in Lynn after each had emigrated from Greece years earlier. The two married in October of 1906. Aristotle was the youngest of their seven children. He may have been a surprise baby, because his mother was 43 and his father 54 when he was born. The family nicknamed him Harry, which is what most people knew him as. And the family resided on Waterhill Street in West Lynn, in a largely Greek neighborhood. His street was narrow and lined with clapboard homes and apartments. At home, Harry spoke mainly Greek, and on the weekend, the family attended a Greek Orthodox church. As he grew up, Harry became known as a talented athlete, both in his neighborhood and the larger city. As a teenager, Harry was nicknamed the Golden Greek. He was a three-sport star athlete at Lynn Classical High School. The building where Harry took classes in the 1940s, it's still in use to this day, but now it's an alternative school for students. Harry's abilities on the field drew the attention of professional baseball, basketball, and football teams. As a left-handed quarterback, defensive back, kicker, and punter, he led his team to a 21-1-1 record over two seasons. Following an undefeated junior year in 1946, the Lynn football team traveled to Miami, Florida, where they defeated Granby High of Norfolk, Virginia on Christmas Day, allowing them to win the mythical National High School Football Championship. Harry and his teammates declined an invitation to a similar game his senior year, after they were told that their black teammates were not welcome to play. Over his three-year high school football career, the All-American Harry Aganis completed 65% of his passes, 326 for 502 for 4,149 yards and 48 touchdowns. He also rushed for 48 additional touchdowns, kicked 39 extra points, and averaged more than 40 yards per punt. In the 1940s, the Boston Red Sox established a Class B New England League farm team in Lynn. Dick O'Connell, who eventually became general manager of the Red Sox, he served as the Lynn team's business manager. Being in the community, O'Connell was able to watch Harry closely, and it's reported that he talked the Red Sox into signing Harry's high school football and baseball coach, Bill Joyce, as president of the Lynn Red Sox. Courting the young athlete, Harry was invited to work out with the team on occasion, in addition to taking on odd jobs for the club. In 1947, Harry hit .352 to lead Lynn Classical to the Massachusetts State Baseball Championship. Harry was named the state's Player of the Year and was chosen to play in the 1947 Hearst Sandlot Classic at the Polo Grounds in New York. The Sandlot Classic was played in New York from the mid-40s until the mid-1960s. This was an amazing opportunity for young athletes to perform in a stadium in front of scouts and fans alike. I believe that an invitation to the Classic included more than the opportunity for them to play at a true stadium. There were tours of the city, they attended a Broadway show, and other cultural events. With the amount of talent Harry displayed, it's no surprise that he received scholarship offers from dozens of colleges, including such programs of national renown as Notre Dame and the University of Tennessee. Harry, whose father George had died in 1946 at the age of 70, he surprised a lot of people when he declined better offers from more prestigious schools. He announced he would be attending Boston University. Choosing a local school allowed him to remain close to his widowed mother. Playing for Boston University meant that the Red Sox fans did not have to travel far to catch Harry in action on the gridiron. You see, the Boston University Terriers, they played their home games at Fenway Park. Playing for the freshman squad, Harry was 29 for 52 for 492 passing yards and 5 touchdowns in 4 games. He averaged 4.7 yards per carry rushing and scored 4 touchdowns on the ground. As a sophomore in 1949, Harry set a school record with 15 touchdown passes while completing 55 of 108 tosses for 762 yards. Harry was named a second-team All-American. We can't say what numbers he would have put up as a 20-year-old, because like many others before him, his college career was cut short by the Korean conflict. While still in high school, Harry enlisted in the United States Marines 2nd Infantry Organized Reserve Battalion, and he was called to active duty in the spring of 1950. While he never went overseas, Harry served a 15-month hitch at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, where he played for the football and baseball teams. In the summer of 1950, Harry hit 362 to lead his team to a 72-17 record, and this was against clubs stocked with former major league pitchers. Harry's squad reached the National Baseball Congress Tournament in Wichita, Kansas, where Harry was named MVP. Harry would receive a dependency discharge from the military. This allowed him to help support his mother, and he returned to Boston and to the university in September of 1951. While he had yet to play professionally, Harry appeared on the cover of prestigious Sport magazine, and in the spring of 52, Harry Aganis was selected with the 12th overall pick in the first round of the National Football League draft. He was chosen by Paul Brown, coach of the Cleveland Browns. Brown hoped that Harry would succeed legendary quarterback Otto Graham. Instead, Harry chose to go back to Boston University for his senior season. After his final football game, which was played November 28, 1952, Harry signed with the hometown Red Sox for $50,000, far less than the reported $100,000 bonus offered by the Cleveland Browns. And listeners, I imagine that the ability to remain in Boston, to stay close to his mother and siblings, I suspect that had a lot to do with him choosing the Red Sox over the Browns. In 1953, Harry, a left-handed hitting and throwing first baseman, went to Sarasota to train with the Red Sox, but he was soon optioned to Louisville. Harry had a respectable season in the American Association, 23 home runs, 108 RBIs, and he finished second to Don Zimmer of St. Paul in voting for League Rookie of the Year. And this was the year that Zimmer was struck in the head by a pitch, a hit that required he undergo brain surgery, which was a risky proposition in those days. In 1954, Aganis showed up to camp ready to battle Dick Gernert for the first base job. Gernert, a tall right-hander from a baseball family, his uncle was a major leaguer, he'd hit 21 homers in 1953. But as spring training went on, it looked like Harry got the job. Meanwhile, Paul Brown is still trying to get Harry to come to the Cleveland Browns. Brown made frequent phone calls to Harry, hoping to get him on the field in Ohio, but he was not successful. Harry made his big league debut against the Philadelphia Athletics on April 13, 1954, pinch hitting in the 8th inning. On April 15th at Fenway Park, Harry started at first base and went 2-for-3. Crushing a deep drive to right field off Washington's Bob Porterfield for an RBI triple. 3 days later, in the second half of an April 18th doubleheader, Harry hit his first major league home run, a 3-run shot at Fenway to carry the Red Sox to a 4-3 victory. At the end of the 54 season, Mike Higgins, Harry's manager at Louisville, he replaced Lou Boudreau at the Red Sox helm. The biggest position battle the next spring involved Harry, who was now challenged at first base by rookie Norm Zouchin. A big right-handed hitter, Zouchin played well for Higgins in Louisville in 1954, while Harry had slumped in the second half of his rookie campaign. Zouchin outhit Harry in spring training and earned the position to start the season. After Zouchin went hitless in the season's first three games, Harry started the next three, and by May 4th, Zouchin was hitting 189, and Harry earned himself a spot in the roster. Don't feel too sorry for Zouchin. The Michigan native would have a longer professional career than Harry, playing for the Red Sox and the Senators through the 1950s, and he retired from the minor leagues in 1960. Meanwhile, in Boston, with Ted Williams temporarily retired from the sport due to personal issues, Harry began hitting Ted's customary third spot in the batting order. Over the next month, Harry improved his batting average above 300. On May 15th, in Boston, there was a doubleheader against the Tigers. Harry went 5-for-10 with two doubles and a triple, boosting his average to 307, 10th in the league. After the doubleheader, the Red Sox were in fifth place, 7.5 games out of first with a record of 14-18. And players are looking forward to their off day, but Harry arrived in Fenway seeking trainer Jack Fadden. Harry said he was experiencing a bad cough and pain in his right side. When the trainer found a fever, Harry was admitted to Sancta Maria Hospital nearby Cambridge. The team physician, Dr. Timothy Lamphere, he diagnosed pneumonia in the right lung, and Harry was hospitalized for 10 days. He would rejoin the team on May 27th for a series with the Washington Senators, but he did not take the field. Those close to Harry were worried. The young athlete was weak and pale, with a persistent cough, and he was sweaty. The next week, Harry finally got another start against the White Sox, but with Ted Williams back in the lineup, Harry batted fourth behind his star teammate. Harry would go 2-for-4, including a double. From what I read, this double, it could have been a triple, but when he got to second base, he sat down on the base, exhausted. And it doesn't say, but I'm wondering if Aganis was pulled or if a pinch runner was sent in to take his place. Harry did stay in the game, and he managed one more hit, a short fly to right field. They didn't know it, but this would be Harry's final at-bat. For the season, he'd hit .313 with 10 doubles, a triple, and no home runs. That night, Harry accompanied the team to Kansas City, and his teammates listened to Harry cough. And he still didn't look quite right. When the trainer saw him in the morning, Harry was flown back to Boston and taken directly to the hospital. Another set of doctors looked at him, and he was diagnosed with pneumonia and phlebitis. Harry told the doctors he'd noticed a lump on his calf a few weeks earlier, which turned out to be a swollen venal wall. Medical staff kept his leg wrapped in ice to prevent clotting. And Harry, who was normally strong and vital, appeared diminished as he battled the pneumonia. Teammates and fans alike were shocked to hear how ill the young player was. The team doctor told the press that Harry was gravely ill and that they were dealing with a complicated case. On June 16th, Harry was placed on the voluntary retired list. This allowed him to stay with the team, but not take up space on the roster. For weeks, Harry lay in hospital, battling pneumonia and circulatory issues. On Monday, June 27th, the medical team decided to move Harry from his bed, which he'd been confined to for weeks. They wanted to put him in a chair so he could sit up. The medical staff transferred him, but in the midst of the move, Harry complained of pain in his chest. What they didn't realize is that a blood clot had broken free from the vein in his calf, and it had reached his lung, causing a pulmonary embolism. 20 minutes later, the great Harry Aganis, idol of a region, was dead. As he lay dying, Harry whispered to a nurse, "Take care of my mother. Be sure that she is all right." Harry was survived by his mother and six older siblings, two sisters and four brothers. News of his death shocked the community, both in Boston, where he'd grown up and known great success on the field, and across the nation as baseball fans reeled from the shocking news. The Red Sox were playing out of state when they learned what had happened. The team wore black armbands for the next month to honor their teammate and friend. Harry's body lay in repose at St. George Greek Orthodox Church in Lynn for a day and a half. More than 10,000 mourners filed past the coffin. For the viewing, Harry was dressed in his favorite suit, and among the many mourners who paid their respects were hundreds of Little League players dressed in their uniforms. 20,000 people lined the one-mile funeral route from the church to Harry's hillside grave in Pine Grove Cemetery, which overlooked the Manning Bowl, where many of his sports heroics had played out. To this day, questions remain about how Harry, such a strong, vibrant athlete, could die surrounded by numerous doctors and nurses. The modest Cambridge hospital where Harry was being treated and died was the Red Sox team hospital, but it wasn't as well regarded as other larger facilities in the area. Perhaps if he'd been treated elsewhere or by more experienced physicians, there would have been a different outcome. According to Harry's family, prior to his death, Harry spoke of returning to football. If true, he would have played quarterback that fall for the Baltimore Colts, who had acquired his rights from the Browns. The legend of Harry Agganis remains strong and visible in Boston. His football number, 33, was retired at both Lynn Classical High School and at Boston University. In 1953, Harry was inducted into the Boston University Hall of Fame. At the induction, he declined gifts of a car and $4,000, and instead asked that the cash equivalent be put toward establishing a Boston University scholarship for Greek American students. Harry would be inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1974. In 1995, Gaffney Street in Boston was renamed Harry Agganis Way in his honor. And in 2004, Agganis Arena, a 7,200-seat sports and entertainment facility, was dedicated in Harry's honor on the Boston University campus. The Agganis Foundation was established in 1956 by the Boston Red Sox. From its inception through 2019, the foundation has awarded more than $2 million in scholarships to 780 student-athletes from throughout eastern Massachusetts. Harry is buried next to his parents at the Pine Grove Cemetery in Lynn. The Deadball podcast is created by Tim Scott. This week's episode was written by Nina Instead and Tim Scott. Chuck Walters is our technical consultant and audio editor. If you're enjoying the podcast, take a moment to leave a rating or a review on your favorite podcatcher. It helps other baseball lovers find the show and the stories shared here. To learn more, or to talk with like-minded baseball fans, join the Deadball discussion group on Facebook.